no serious historian will doubt the existence of a person called Jesus.
The question is, what can we know for certain about his life? Most of the evidence we have comes from four sources: the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
These books are traditionally ascribed to followers of Jesus from his own day, but scholars have recognized for a long time that, in fact, they were probably not written by Jesus' own followers, who were Aramaic-speaking peasants from Galilee. These Gospels are written in Greek by highly educated people, probably living decades after Jesus, so they're not eyewitness accounts. One of the most difficult tasks that New Testament scholars have is deciding what in the stories found in the Gospels is historical and what is legendary. Once you make that separation, you're able to see what the historical Jesus was really like, but you're also able to see how storytellers wanted to present Jesus to their audiences.
That was a clip from a documentary featuring the well-known atheist New Testament scholar, Bart Ehrman. So what are we to make of claims of this kind? Are the Gospels best understood as collections of stories that over time began to incorporate a variety of myths and fables about Jesus? According to Cambridge New Testament scholar Richard Bauckham, this hypothesis, which has been popular in the world of New Testament scholarship for the past century or more, no longer holds water and needs to be abandoned. Instead, he argues that the best way of reading the four Gospels is to see them as rooted in eyewitness testimony.
Bart Ehrman's a good example of a very traditional scholar in the sense that he just goes along with a major trend of 20th century gospel scholarship and really doesn't question it. I mean, there's a strong tendency, you see, for people not actually to question the views that have become the consensus in the previous generation. You know, these scholars must have got it right and they made that the basis for their own work. To then think, well, maybe those scholars got some things seriously wrong is quite disturbing to one's sense of what one's been doing oneself. But of course, if you abandon one paradigm, you've got to have another paradigm. And of course, the eyewitness contention is itself very controversial.
On this episode of the Humble Skeptic Podcast, I'll be airing a conversation I recorded with Richard Bauckham about the value of eyewitness testimony and why he's convinced that a close study of the four Gospels indicates that they are not, in fact, collections of stories and legends that evolved over time, but should be seen as authentic reports written by Jesus' followers and their associates.
Faith is believing in something you can't see, you can't feel, something that can't be proven.
Then how do you know which is the right faith?
I think that's a gut thing.
I don't think about a right faith. I think about what resonates with me. I feel authentic. It brings me peace.
I think there is no absolute truth in any religion. I think it's a matter of subjective experience.
I kind of just trust my intuition, trust my gut.
You just know. You just gotta follow it.
Just don't follow what you think is your faith.
If faith is blind, then what makes one belief better or worse than any other? And if it's just a leap in the dark, why should any of us feel obligated to believe anything at all? My name is Shane Rosenthal. I was raised in a Jewish home, but became an atheist at a very young age. Later, as I began to question things, I ended up losing faith in my atheism and converted to Christianity. Since that time, I've never stopped asking questions, and I've spoken with authors and scholars from all over the world in order to explore the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives. Over the years, one thing I've concluded is this: we're all believers. But because there are so many conflicting ideas and worldviews out there, we just can't all be right. So how do we find the truth? On this podcast, we'll start by asking questions.
I'm really just trying to figure out what I believe right now.
Hey there, welcome back to the Humble Skeptic Podcast. I'm your host, Shane Rosenthal. And on this episode, we'll be hearing from Richard Bauckham, who is arguably the most highly regarded New Testament scholar of our time. In his widely acclaimed 2006 book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Dr. Bauckham presented compelling evidence that, contrary to popular opinion, The four Gospels shouldn't be dismissed as collections of stories and legends, but instead should be seen as trustworthy eyewitness reports written either by Jesus' own disciples or their associates. One fascinating aspect of Bauckham's work relates to his use of a database containing thousands of ancient Palestinian Jewish names collected from available texts and inscriptions of various kinds. Essentially, he argues that when you combine all the names from the four Gospels and the Book of Acts, the 10 most commonly used names are nearly identical to the top 10 names found in this database of ancient Jewish names. Skeptical New Testament scholar Jens Schroeder was critical of this part of Bauckham's research, saying that this only shows that the Gospel authors attempted to give their fictional narratives a realistic effect. But in his more recent updated edition of his book, Bauckham took the opportunity to respond to critics like Schroeder, saying that, quote, "Even supposing that a gospel writer would try to make the range of his names realistic, he was only responsible for one gospel. No one planned the data we get from putting all four gospels together. While contemporaries would realize that some names were common and others rare, they are unlikely to have known the relative proportions of name usage. Therefore, he says, the evidence is much more precise and strongly suggests that the names we find in the gospels are those of historic individuals," end quote. In one of the newer chapters that was included in the updated edition of Jesus and the Eyewitnesses that was released a few years ago, Bauckham went so far as to suggest that form criticism had officially reached a dead end. Form criticism is the theory that the Gospels were oral stories that changed over time before they were eventually written down close to a century later. Many New Testament scholars, he writes, seem to suppose that the more skeptical of the sources they are, the more rigorously historical is their method. But this isn't how history actually works. In everyday life, we do not systematically mistrust everything everyone tells us. When someone who is in a good position to know what they tell us does so, we normally believe them. But we keep our critical faculties alert and raise questions if there is a specific reason to doubt. Of course, many raise doubts about some of the things recorded in the Gospels because they just seem too fantastic. Perhaps such things are better explained as some kind of ancient superstition, rather than as a set of concrete historical facts. What's particularly intriguing, however, is that in his book, Did Jesus Exist?, Bart Ehrman himself acknowledges not only that Jesus was a real historical individual who lived in Palestine in the early part of the first century, but he also acknowledges that this same Jesus was known to be a wonder worker. Specifically referring to the source material provided by Luke, Ehrman writes that none of this information was invented by the author, nor was it a product of Luke's fertile imagination. Rather, he says his report, quote, "incorporates much older traditions that are quite emphatic that Jesus was a Jewish man who lived, did spectacular deeds, taught, and was executed as a human in Jerusalem." In recent times, some have attempted to deny the general reliability of eyewitness testimony itself. Along these lines, you may have seen a video or two attempting to demonstrate how we can often fail to notice things that are happening all around us.
Did you spot the van changing to a taxi? How about the scooter changing to a pair of bicycles? Or the lady holding a pig? Let alone the fact that the entire street is now completely different. Didn't think so.
Now, if eyewitness testimony itself isn't viewed as reliable, then what does this suggest about its role in our legal system? And more importantly, what does it say about the information recorded in the Gospels, even if they are found to be rooted and grounded in eyewitness testimony? I put these questions to Richard Bauckham.
I think the issue of whether eyewitness testimony is generally reliable is one that has been investigated at considerable length in recent times by cognitive psychologists, whose interest, of course, is sparked particularly by the importance of eyewitness testimony in our legal system. So it's in a way, a very important issue from the point of view of how we try people and convict them of crimes and so forth.
Otherwise, the trial is just based on circumstantial evidence. So the eyewitness testimony is the heart of the trial.
Exactly. So it's a really important issue. And a lot of people have got the impression in recent years that eyewitness testimony is highly unreliable. But I think you have to look more closely at the results of their work. A lot of the problem in court testimony is that what you're asking someone to remember is something that they weren't interested in observing at the time. you know, they were just bystanders. And you might want to know, you know, what sort of car was it? You know, and they hadn't noticed. They weren't really looking for that. And another interesting phenomenon is people are actually there at the scene of a crime. There's a phenomenon where they fixate on the weapon. So if someone is waving a gun around, their memory is very much focused on the gun. They forget, they just don't notice actually lots of things that are going on around, because people's attention is focused on what they're interested in or what draws their attention for various reasons. And you can imagine if someone's holding a gun, that's the thing you focus on. So there are all kinds of different ways in which eyewitness testimony can be reliable or not reliable. And if you look at the kind of testimony that the Gospels purport to give us, these are not events that bystanders happen to notice. These are the testimony of people who were involved in the events. They were interested and involved, and these events affected them. And those are things people tend to remember very well. Another aspect of it is that you remember things well if you recall them fairly soon after the events, and if you go on recalling those memories. So if there's a story you tell, and you often tell it to people you meet, the evidence is that that story will take a pretty standard form in your memory very soon after it happened. And it will retain that sort of basic shape when you are telling it to other people. And of course, that is what would have happened in the case of the memories of Jesus. People just didn't go away and forget all about it, and then 50 years later, someone asked them to recall them. These are stories that they were telling again and again.
What Professor Baucom is saying is that we shouldn't think of Jesus' disciples simply as bystanders who may have incorrectly perceived who Jesus was or what he did. No, these men spent the better part of 3 years traveling with him from town to town, where they no doubt had opportunities to hear him give many of the same messages over and over again. They in turn would spend the rest of their lives telling Jesus' story, which included not only his miraculous deeds, but also his teaching. After all, they were his disciples, whose job it was to spread his message.
Now, the psychological research shows what really sticks in the mind is the gist of an event, you know, the sort of key elements of an event. Details, peripheral details, might vary from one telling to another. And that's a good reason, I think, for not really being too bothered about the minor differences that you get between the Gospels when they're recounting the same event. I mean, those minor differences are what you might well expect in memory. And furthermore, ancient people who told stories, even when they were writing history, would vary the details for kind of narrative effect. And everybody knew that, and everybody was quite happy with that. I mean, an obvious example where people do have problems, I think, sometimes is the differences in the accounts of the visit of the women to the empty tomb. They are rather different. And I think we may well have the memories of different individuals among that group of women in those four cases. I mean, it's actually quite interesting that in the Acts of the Apostles, where you have the narrative of Paul's experience on the Damascus Road, when he meets the risen Jesus on the Damascus Road, and Luke tells us the story, and then later in Acts, he has Paul telling the story himself to other people. So we actually have three accounts, and they do differ on small details. But Luke, as a good historian, isn't bothered about that, because he knows that's what happens, that's what everybody was quite familiar with. It doesn't throw any doubt on the substance of the narrative.
At this point, I should admit that earlier in my faith, I was quite uncomfortable with some of the important differences that existed between the gospel accounts, of the resurrection in particular. But as I've gotten older, I actually see these differences as a sign of authenticity. Why should there be four slightly different accounts of Jesus' resurrection if the story was fabricated by the believing community? And why did they become a believing community in the first place, after their leader had been crucified? In his classic work, A Practical Treatise of the Law of Evidence, written back in 1833, Thomas Starkey observed that the usual character of human testimony is substantial truth under circumstantial variety. It so rarely happens, he says, that witnesses of the same transaction perfectly and entirely agree in all points connected with it, that an entire and complete coincidence in every particular actually engenders suspicion. One of the lines of evidence that Richard Bauckham discusses in his books that lends additional credibility to the suggestion that the Gospels are rooted in eyewitness testimony is something he and other scholars refer to as protective anonymity. So I asked him to explain what this is.
It's not an idea that I came up with in an original sense. German scholar Gerd Tyson suggested this. I think the really striking instance of this in Mark's Gospel is the woman who anoints Jesus in Bethany. And Jesus praises her and he says, you know, this woman will be remembered wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, and yet she's unnamed. It's very strange. And the idea of protective anonymity is that in the early period, say in the 40s, when these stories would have circulated as a kind of passion story at an early stage, and the people who put Jesus to death, Caiaphas and his cronies, were powerful people in Jerusalem for a long time. And in fact, the same family eventually was responsible for the death of Jesus' brother James in the year 62, as Josephus tells us. So it was dangerous to be known as someone who had played some of these roles in Jesus' time in Jerusalem. And so it's protective in the sense that they're not being explicitly identified. And, you know, Peter cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant. You know, it's a direct assault, as it were, on the high priest's authority. And the woman anoints Jesus. I mean, she anoints him as the Messiah. You know, this is the act that, you know, in the eyes of the high priests, precipitated Jesus' claim to be Messiah. So these people are in real danger. And so they remained anonymous, of course, within the circle of Jesus' disciples, people who heard the stories and talked about them. It would be known who these were, but it would be a sort of secret knowledge, a knowledge that people guarded, didn't make very public. So it's quite intelligible, therefore, if these people were anonymous in this early narrative, which is the way Peter was still telling it when he told it to Mark and it got recorded in Mark's Gospel. But then in John's time, writing long after the events and way outside Palestine, this concern is no longer relevant in John's time. And so he can tell us that this woman who anointed Jesus was called Mary, the sister of Martha. And he can tell us that it was Peter who cut off the servant's ear. And he can tell us about Lazarus. And the thing about Lazarus is you could not have told Lazarus's story without everybody knowing who it was. And so the only way you could protect Lazarus's anonymity in the early days in Jerusalem was not to tell that story. And so the fact that the story of the raising of Lazarus does not appear in the other Gospels, but plays a really important part in John's story, I think can be explained on that basis.
The point Richard Bauckham made there might be difficult to grasp at first, but when you spend some time looking closely at the related passages, it becomes clear that Lazarus was in need of protection. According to John chapter 12, when a large crowd came to see not only Jesus, but Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead, the chief priests made plans to put Lazarus to death as well, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. Because of this threat, Bauckham and other scholars have argued that Lazarus likely went into hiding, and that this fact accounts for why the first three gospel writers decided not to talk about him. Writing from Ephesus during a safer period, John was free to tell his story. Another scene that Bauckham mentioned briefly had to do with the cutting off of the ear of the high priest's servant. The first three gospels simply state that this was done by one of the disciples on the night Jesus was arrested, whereas John reveals that this was done by Peter. Commenting on this scene, liberal New Testament scholar C.H. Dodd observed that, quote, "If we're to take an account of the general probabilities of the situation, we should reflect that if there were two swords among the 12, as Luke says there were, it's more than likely that Peter had one of them, and if he had, he was, so far as we know of him, not one to let it rest in his sheath. Therefore, it's not difficult to see why this fact may have been covered over at a time when Peter was a marked man, and it was not politic to let him be represented as a man of violence, above all as one who had deliberately affronted the high priest in the person of his servant." End quote. According to Bauckham, Gert Thiessen is the scholar who came up with the term protective anonymity, and here's what he writes in the case of Peter. Quote, "It seems to me that the motive for this anonymity is not hard to guess. Peter had run foul of the police. The one who draws his sword commits no minor offense when he cuts off someone's ear. As long as the high priest's slave was alive, it would have been inopportune to mention names. Their anonymity is for their protection. Only in Jerusalem was there reason to draw a cloak of anonymity over followers of Jesus who had endangered themselves by their actions." Another curious observation that Bauckham makes in his writings relates to a shift that can be observed in Mark's gospel, where Peter and the other male disciples are typically front and center in his narrative until the climactic scenes of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, where they are completely out of the picture since they have fled after Jesus' arrest. According to Bauckham, this is where verbs of seeing in Mark's narrative switch from the male disciples to the role of the women.
This is something that goes back to what Papias says about Mark's gospel, that it was based on Peter's testimony, that Mark worked as Peter's interpreter, translator, presumably, and wrote down the stories about Jesus and the sayings of Jesus as he had heard them from Peter. And Peter is the most prominent character in the gospel after Jesus. He's mentioned more often than anyone else. And Peter is present at almost everything that happens until, of course, the famous event in which he denied Jesus three times and disappears from the narrative at that point. So Peter, and in fact none of the other male disciples are present from that bit of the narrative onwards. And of course, what happens after that are some of the really, really important events in Mark's story, the death of Jesus, Jesus' burial, the discovery of his empty tomb. And if Mark cares about his eyewitness sources, it would be rather remarkable if he has no eyewitness sources for those concluding events of the story, really important events of the story. And therefore, it's very interesting that the women disciples of Jesus, who Mark actually has not referred to earlier in the gospel at all, Luke does, but Mark has nothing about them until he gets to this point in the story. And then he tells us Jesus' women disciples were present with Jesus when he was dying on the cross. And he names three of those women, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and Salome. And he says they were observing what went on when Jesus died. And then he tells us that two of them were present, observing what was going on when Jesus was buried in the tomb. And then he has all three of those named women appearing again in his last story, really, the visit of the women to the empty tomb, where they find the tomb empty and hear the message of the angels that he has risen. Now, if you look at what he says about these women, carefully distinguished by name, almost everything he says about them, he says in verbs of seeing. They see and they look and they notice and they observe.
And they behold.
They behold, a whole series of Greek words for seeing. So really, it's quite clear that the important thing about these women is that they see. They see what goes on. They see Jesus die. They see where he's buried. They see that the tomb is empty. So I think it's actually really clear that these women, as it were, are stepping into the role that Peter had played in Mark's narrative up to that point. They're the witnesses for this later part of the story.
At the beginning of this program, I mentioned the fact that in the latest edition of Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Richard Bauckham argues that form criticism has officially reached a dead end. So I asked him to discuss this point by first explaining what form criticism is.
Form criticism originated in the early 20th century. It was a way of looking at the Gospels that came from German scholars at the time, Rudolf Bultmann and Martin Debailius, and others followed in their footsteps. What they did was to compare the Gospels with folk literature, German fairy tales, stuff like that. And they said that the stories about Jesus would have been handed down orally by the early Christians within the early Christian communities. And they called it form criticism because they distinguished the different literary forms of the stories. The point was they thought they could trace how these stories developed from mouth to mouth, as it were, until they got put into the Gospels. So this was a theory which, as it were, removed the eyewitnesses from the Gospel writers by this long process of oral transmission, in which anything could have happened. And it was very, very widely accepted. And some scholars accepted it, and conservatively, they thought the early Christian communities preserved the traditions about Jesus quite faithfully until they were written down by the evangelists. Others read the story as very radically. The former critics themselves were very keen on the creativity of the early communities, who weren't really interested in what had happened. It didn't really matter much whether these stories went back to the historical life of Jesus.
So at the end of the day, the Gospels end up being records of the faith of the believing community toward the end of the first century, not accurate pictures of who Jesus was in his first century context?
Yes, yes, indeed. I think that's right. When I started writing Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, it's a book that developed as I wrote it. And I thought there were some problems with form criticism. I expected to say they got some things right and some things wrong, you know, a sort of balanced assessment. I ended up thinking they got almost everything wrong. All I had to do was to compile criticisms that other scholars had made. And you put them all together and you find there's really nothing left. I mean, one thing is that they didn't know much about oral tradition. We now know much, much more about how oral tradition works because we have ethnographic studies from all over the world where oral tradition is important. So that their whole account of how the gospel traditions would have been transmitted really doesn't stand up to modern study of oral tradition. That's one aspect of how they got it wrong. So I ended up thinking, you know, they were largely a kind of misleading development in gospel scholarship, which had a huge, huge influence. And I therefore work with the notion instead that the way the eyewitnesses told the stories is at least very close to the evangelists. And I think the individual evangelists are related in slightly different ways to the eyewitnesses. I think Mark is a very good second-hand witness to how Peter and the women disciples told the story of Jesus. John, I think, wrote the gospel himself. He's an eyewitness himself and wrote the gospels. And Luke, again, is different. But what I try to argue is that the eyewitness testimony is closely behind the text that we have. The usual dates of the gospels are entirely compatible with thinking that they are quite closely based on the eyewitness testimony.
Do you think that form criticism today still continues to govern the way most New Testament scholars think about the text, or are you beginning to see a change?
I think that most New Testament scholars, I mean, if you think about it, if you worked with a particular sort of paradigm for how you work with the Gospels for a long career, you're not going to abandon it in a hurry. And I think it's therefore very natural that if my argument gains ground, it will be among younger scholars. And I think one can say that that's happening in general. But I also think that although most older scholars pay lip service to form criticism, they actually make far less use of it than was done in the past. So I think there's a sense in which the real force of form criticism has waned and some of their key points have been abandoned. But of course, if you abandon one paradigm, you've got to have another paradigm. And of course, the eyewitnesses' contention is itself very controversial. So I think there's probably reluctance to adopt this new paradigm, which has all kinds of implications about the reliability of the Gospels, which, you know, go against scholarly trends. So I don't expect this to be a kind of revolution that is successful overnight. It's something that people are rightly engaging with and assessing. But I do think it's getting a hearing. I mean, one of the nice things about the reviews of the first edition was that a whole lot of scholars who I didn't expect to agree with the book and didn't, but a whole lot of them said this is a really important book that everyone would have to take account of. I think that's a good sign.
But you are saying, though, that the foundation upon which skeptical New Testament scholars like Bart Ehrman stand on has crumbled.
I think that is true, yes. I mean, I think Bart Ehrman's a good example of a very traditional scholar in the sense that he just goes along with a major trend of 20th century gospel scholarship, which was never, of course, the only trend, and really doesn't question it. He just goes along with it and takes it for granted. I mean, there's a strong tendency, you see, if you're engaged in the study of a subject, New Testament scholars, I think, like to see the history of their study as a kind of progressive science, you know, in which each generation builds on the firm results of the previous generation, you know. So there's a strong tendency for people not actually to question the views that have become the consensus in the previous generation. The idea of supposing that some influential development might have been mistaken is not something people take easily to, because it seems to contradict this idea of the discipline as a progressive science. But it's not a progressive science. You know, that's really not how it works. And it's entirely possible that serious mistakes have been made and now we know better. And we need always to be re-examining, you know, the foundations of the consensus of the last generation. We can't just assume that everybody got it right and, you know, we can just build on that. But I think there is a certain reluctance of people to do that. You know, people who are students of some of the great scholars of the past, you know, they lapped it up, they accepted, you know, these scholars must have got it right, and they made that the basis for their own work. To then think, well, maybe those scholars got some things seriously wrong, is quite disturbing to one's sense of what one's been doing oneself.
Folks, thanks for joining me for this episode of the Humble Skeptic Podcast as I've been airing a conversation I recorded with Cambridge New Testament scholar Richard Baucom. Next week, I'll air the second part of this discussion as we talk more specifically about questions related to the eyewitness testimony and historical reliability of the Gospel of John. As always, be sure to check out the show notes for books and articles related to this discussion, which you can find at humbleskeptic.com. That's humbleskeptic.com, and I look forward to being with you again next time as we discuss the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives.